Hello, everyone. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on the effective collector, skills and techniques to maximize collections. While it would be great for all collectors to be all-stars, every agency executive knows that at the end of the day, that just isn't a reality. But what is a reality is having an agency full of effective collectors who are good at their jobs and like what they do. In this webinar, which is being sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning, we've got a panel of leading experts from across the ARM industry who are here to share their tips and strategies to help collectors maximize their recoveries. As I mentioned, this webinar is being generously sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. Before I introduce our panel, let me take a quick second and give you my spiel about AccountsRecovery.net. For those of you who haven't heard it yet, and if you haven't, I can't imagine how you haven't. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, publishes email newsletters, hosts awesome webinars like this one, offers a number of exciting podcasts and video channels, and manages a Slack channel all for the ARM industry. All of that great content is free for anyone in the industry to use and absorb and enjoy. And personally, I happen to think it's a great resource of news and insights to help keep everybody educated and informed. I hope you're all spending a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. In her nearly 40-year career in the collections industry, Deborah Siski has been an active contributor on many levels. She served on the ACA International's Board of Directors from 2012 through 2018 and has been an ACA certified instructor since 1983. She's taught more than 200 ACA seminars and has been instrumental and the development of the Credit and Collection Compliance Officer Program, the Trainer Specialist Program, FDCPA Seminars, and numerous others. Deborah is now the Executive Vice President of CACI in St. Louis, Missouri. Irene Hoheisel has been in the collection industry for more than 22 years. She began as a collector and quickly became head of the Collection Department, as well as leading the training, leadership, and compliance departments at ARSI. Irene has served on multiple committees for ACA International, is also an ACA certified instructor and a source for many due to her extensive knowledge in medical collections and the laws that govern. Irene has earned an alphabet soup of designations, certifications, awards, and recognitions for her knowledge in the collection industry. She also serves as president of the Kansas Collectors Association. Michael Jeselnik is a 15-year veteran of the ARM industry and started his career as a collector as well, and has worked his way up to his current role as general manager, overseeing all operations with Carter Young Incorporated, located in Conyers, Georgia. Michael also serves as president of the Georgia Collectors Association. The format for today's webinar is going to be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please either enter it into the Q&A tab or the chat module on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. With that, let me welcome our panel to start our discussion today. Irene, Deborah, Michael, thank you so much for joining me. Really looking forward to hearing you share and speak for the next hour on this topic. So let me start with a fairly simple question. How much time should collection agencies spend training collectors? Let's see, I'm gonna pick Deborah to start first today. Deborah, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mike, for putting this together. I'm looking forward to the conversation that we're going to have here today. And that is a great question. How much time should collection agencies spend training collectors? And, you know, coming from a training background, I would say, God, they should just train them all the time. But of course, then they wouldn't be able to collect any money. So that's not going to justify that kind of training. So, you know, I can't give you a number of minutes or hours, but I would say that the kind of training that you provide has to be commensurate with the training need. And so you look at the needs of each individual in terms of their performance from a compliance perspective, their performance from a dollars collected perspective, perhaps other behaviors that they may display in the office that you think could be improved with training. And then you decide what it's going to take to bring that person up to the expectations that you have for them. So it's going to be different for every person. I mean, you might have people that are super experienced, like someone like Michael who's been in his office for 15 years. And I bet, Michael, you get back on the phone every now and then in your position as a general manager. And so he might not require very much training at all. But I think with new hires, you have to look at it as kind of a curve. So with new hires, you might spend a lot of time training over the course of the first 6 months, and then it's going to dwindle off because they've developed some skills and experience. So then you would spend less time. I would also recommend that, you know, they should be touched by your training department or by some kind of training on a regular basis, maybe every month, just because, you know, learning is an expectation of the job. So that often comes from something a little bit more formal that you can present, whether formally or informally. So, Irene, what do you think about that?
I definitely agree. I would say ditto to everything that Deborah said. What I'd like to add to that is why it also depends is what you collect. If you have an agency that only collects medical debt and that's it, that training is going to be totally different than an agency that has student loan debt and medical debt and credit card debt and banking debt. So there's different laws to teach for each of those types of debt, different techniques, different ways. You know, you don't have to really care as much about reading the specifics of a contract and what created that debt and what kind of interest is being accumulating and why. And, you know, you don't have to even know the Truth in Lending Act if you're a medical debt collector. But for a medical debt collector, you have to teach about insurances, about third-party payers, about deductibles and all different types of insurance issues. And if you're in a state where you have spousal liability with medical debt, you usually have more than one spouse, or you have, not more than one spouse, that's bigamy. You usually have more than one consumer because you have spouses, or you might have parents of a minor child. So there's a lot of different things to teach. So depending on how big your agency is, what type of debt you collect, that's also going to fall into that. I'm a big believer in training them better in the beginning. So if you're talking about training and initial training, I'd rather spend more time and not that rush to get them on the floor. I'd rather spend more time in the very beginning, train them better so like that there's less mistakes. I'm not a real big happy person in collections with all these compliance issues about learning by trial and error. Mm-hmm. Lots of things in life we learn by trial and error. Collecting shouldn't really be one of them. That should be the things you're picking off the back ends, try to fix and tweak. You know, because you can't help it. It is human. We're humans. We're going to make mistakes. Like I say all the time, we don't sell widgets. We sell a product, and that product is a service. So we're only as good as our collectors because they are the ones who give the service. They are our product. Our collectors are our widgets. So make them the best you can. And also, like Deborah said, when it comes to not the initial training, but you have your staff that's your seasoned staff, there's also the difference in training them. It shouldn't end at initial training. It shouldn't end when they're on the floor. Deborah said she wants to train them forever. I agree. You need to have something in place that your staff, your seasoned staff, is always being trained, especially as laws change. Look, we just got our CFPB the 30th. It was published. The rules up till now. We're supposed to be getting our second wave of them on sometime in December, probably the 20th. And I mean, there's going to be a lot of change in the next year for us following these things. And if I tell people that while they're in training class, if you guys aren't good with change, please don't come back tomorrow. Because that's one thing you can be guaranteed in the collection industry is change, which means training.
100%. And Deborah, you are absolutely right. I get on the phone all the time. Mm-hmm. You got to stay sharp. Yeah, I mean, you absolutely have to stay sharp and see what your end user, what your collector is experiencing. What are your consumers like? What works? And most importantly, are you practicing what you're preaching? But as far as the timeline, it never stops. One thing that I try to keep in mind is that every second you have this employee in a training room, you're hemorrhaging money from the head. So get them to learn the information as quickly as possible. And let them get out there. And Irene, I agree with you. I'm not big on compliance mistakes. But when I sit them out there, I do expect them to screw something up.
Right.
And you know what? We'll figure out what they screwed up. We'll fix it. The world's going to continue to spin. And we just sit and wait for the next time they screw something up and start that process over again. Hopefully it's not the same screw up more than once.
Right. So, Michael, I just want to comment on something that you said about pulling people into the classroom for training, because that is costly. And that is what makes some people reluctant to do training. They'll, you know, train via memo or via email. And that's not always useful, because some people, don't read their email or don't absorb a memo, and people then, it leaves things open to interpretation because they don't have the chance to ask questions. So, you know, one thing we're doing right now, just for example, is we're rolling out a whole new quality assurance process, and it's heavily borrows from from compliance. There's a lot of compliance issues, as you can imagine, as you're doing quality assurance calls. There's like 6 related to collection techniques, and there's 30 related to compliance. And so we can't just roll this out with the expectation that everybody knows what they're supposed to do in the first place. So we have we're rolling out compliance training the whole month of December, and we're doing it, you know, I'm kind of now very enamored with microlearning, which means, you know, you can roll out training using an automated platform. You roll out lessons that are 10 or no more than 15 minutes long. I try to keep them to 10 minutes, where you just explain one or two concepts and give examples. You know, you can incorporate call recordings, which I've done, that really are helpful to people to understand how to apply what you're training. Send it out over your platform. They take the little module, they take a quiz of a couple questions, and then they can move on to the next session. And, you know, using a quiz helps you to understand if people have absorbed it. And to me, the real benefit of doing that is, number one, we have people in a couple of different locations. And so you don't have a trainer who's got to, you know, travel back and forth to get all that training done. But also, if people don't seem to get it the first time because you see in their performance they're not doing what you expect, you can just assign them the training again. And, you know, then make sure that someone like a manager or supervisor is having a conversation with them about that content to really make sure they understand it. So we actually, go ahead.
Big fan of microlearning. Fan of microlearning. Hey, I know a guy that's on this call too that might dabble in that a little bit.
Well, exactly. I mean, and we're using the Knowledge Source product to do it, and it's I know this is not a commercial for Knowledge Source, but it's an amazing product and I would recommend it. So there we go.
100%.
Well, as good a time as any for me to interject myself for a minute, and I'm going to introduce Chris Rickman from Peak Revenue Learning, who is the sponsor of today's webinar, to say a few words. Chris.
Thank you, Mike, and hello, everyone. We are grateful for the opportunity to sponsor today's webinar. Our company provides Knowledge Source, the leading workforce education, compliance, and microlearning training platform to companies with collection operations. Knowledge Source is used by our clients to simplify and lower the cost of training new and existing employees. Our clients are companies that want to build and maintain a high level of assurance to staff members have mastered and are maintaining their mastery of the knowledge expected of them when interacting with consumers. Knowledge Source automatically builds documentation of the training efforts of the company for existing and prospective clients or for regulators. For those of you I don't know or haven't met, spent many years on your side of the desk. I've worked in the collection industry for more than 30 years. Most of that time in executive management of a collection firm. Knowledge Source was created to address many of the shortcomings I saw as a COO and CEO. Use Knowledge Source to implement an ongoing, continuous training cycle to reinforce the knowledge you expect your staff members to have. Present collection, client, or company policies to your staff members during onboarding or at ongoing recurring schedules where they acknowledge that they've read and understand those policies and procedures. Present tests during training events to validate learning or on recurring schedules to certify staff knowledge in areas you wish, such as the FDCPA or HIPAA. Present videos or slideshows or audio recordings in onboarding training courses or after a staff member has been released into their job function to reduce the time to proficiency, or even afterward to maintain focus on best practices. In summary, Knowledge Source will close knowledge gaps, promote accountability, lower the cost of training, and document for clients, prospective clients, regulators, your company's proactive role in preventing errors, compliance nonconformities, and in maximizing revenue. To find out more about us, visit peakrevenuelearning.com. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Chris, and thanks again to Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate their continued support. We have a question that came in through the chat box that I'm going to ask now and use it as a reminder for everybody who's watching or listening. If you have a question, use the Q&A button on your Zoom webinar control panel and type it into the chat box. But get it asked, get it submitted, and we'll get an answer during our remaining time today. And the question is, what about offices that are remote, you know, because of COVID? How are you handling training? Which was a question I was going to ask, and maybe you can answer that as well, was are you finding it easier or harder to train collectors during the pandemic? And what have you found is working best to train collectors who are working remotely?
So
Michael, you can go first this time.
Oh, I was going to jump right in. Go ahead, Michael.
I'll
piggyback.
Yeah, we only had a few employees that were working remotely. And it was in essence kind of the same thing, but we would transmit a document to them or send them a link to a video, or we would share and watch a video together and then have a group discussion after it. And again, I guess I'll plug Knowledge Source here one more time, but that product has been pretty crucial in our employees retaining the information that we go over. So the steps are pretty simple. You present the material, you have a quick discussion about the material, and then you further reinforce whatever that material was through this micro learning. And you know, as a manager or trainer, I'm able to see globally, you know, where we might be having some sort of issue. Usually it's because I've written the question in such an insane way, it's difficult to understand, but other times we can drill down and say, you know what, maybe this person just isn't getting this particular thing for some reason, and try to find a different way of explaining it or a different way of teaching it.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. You know, and Knowledge Source has been a godsend for us because we've had nearly all of our employees working from home. So, and then, you know, we have an outsource office that we use a little bit as well that have also been able to take advantage of the training that we've offered our internal folks. So we couldn't have really done the training without that platform. I mean, there are lots of learning management systems, you know, don't get me wrong, and Knowledge Source is not the only one. It's the only one geared for the collection industry, really, that I know of. But you can use really any learning management system that, you know, allows for, you know, people to access it from offsite. And that's the best way to do it. I love Michael's approach to have group discussions about the topics that you're training, because that really helps you to understand if people got it or not. And it really helps to embed that knowledge, because once you've talked about a thing that you've just learned, then it just increases the retention by many, many percentage points. And so I recommend that to you.
I agree. It's harder, definitely harder to train, initial train offsite than it was what onsite, you know, you get to see the person, you can see the reaction, you observe if they're looking, if they're on their phone. It's much easier to see, you know, if they're doing things they aren't supposed to, when you say, hey, is that your phone in your lap? Why isn't it in the cubby? Well, you're not going to see that when they're at home. So there's things like that that do make it harder, but it doesn't mean it can't be good training. I mean, we found that with initial training, we had to tweak quite a few things. As a matter of fact, I have a class going right now, and my trainer, here's where the problem came in. He just called me this morning, and now we have to go get tested for COVID. So hopefully he'll still be able to train. But what we did, we have a couple of different things that we use. I've been very lucky. My lead trainer is great at creating new things and coming up with these wonderful ideas. And one of the things that we came up with, when you talk about the micro learning, is we did actually on PowerPoint, believe it or not, because I have a touch screen on my computer, we did some fun animated 10-minute like clips about different subjects to add to some of the training, to break it up a little bit in between, because that face-to-face training, you could play games a little bit easier to break things up. But the remote training, you're not in group settings. It's a little bit harder to get that peer activity going. So he's created some really great things himself. But I could tell you that we use GoToMeeting and Zoom, but we also use this remote connect. I think it's called ConnectWise, that our IT department uses to remote into our computer. So like if I'm having an issue on my laptop at any time, I could just call them, they'll remote in and they could do their thing, their magic, and they could fix it. Well, we could also do that where our leads and our supervisors and our trainers could do the same thing with staff where they could remote in. And through our call manager, where we do our dialer, we also have a barge in thing that we could do, or a whisper. So we could listen to live calls while it's happening and either barge in to stop it or whisper into the ear of the collector. So the consumer won't hear, but the collector will. It's a little to get used to, but it's worked really, really well. But one of the bigger things, in my opinion, is preparation. If you're not preparing for that, because we do a lot of tests. Deborah talked about quizzes. I'm a big believer in tests. For instance, one of the things we do, we have a game that we play, because I don't train anymore. You know, I used to be the lead trainer, but now I oversee it. And but I still want my hands in it to see what my trainer is doing and to see how the staff is reacting to him. And I have this one game that I love to play. It's FDCPA versus FCRA. It's a bunch of true or false things, but they have to brainstorm among themselves. We sit back and we watch, and they have to place things on different columns, if it's true or false. Is it FDCPA? Is it FCRA? And my trainer knows when they do that activity, he has to do it around my schedule, because I want, whether it's remote or I'm there, I want to watch. Because not only do I hear their conversations and I could tell what he's telling them and what he's not, but I could hear if they all hear the same thing wrong, if they're not understanding certain things, it's probably my trainer's fault. But I could also hear the ones that I could tell were listening and the ones that I could tell were just sitting there and doing nothing, just filling up a chair. It's amazing, but we prepare for that. We know that it's something that Irene wants to be there and I have to listen to. And I do really honestly think, especially with remote learning, that the people that you trust the most should be some way involved, even if it's playing an activity with them remotely or doing what I do and sit in on that game. I also could assess my trainer with that game. But those type of things are going to make it easier. Creating PowerPoints, if you don't have the money to go to get all these different types of vendors to participate with you, if you have anybody in your company that's good with Excel, PowerPoint, things like that, PowerPoint is amazing, the things that you could do with it when you play with it. And those learning sessions are there forever. We use things like SurveyMonkey for tests because we have all that archived information. We can change our tests very easily. We get test results from anybody who's taken it. It's very easy for our admin department to, you know, create an email that goes out to all new hires with the link to the tests and when it comes back. I mean, just simplify whatever you can. These are all inexpensive ways to be able to train remotely. But the biggest thing is preparation. If you're not prepared for it, I guarantee you, you're going to fail because it's not like face-to-face. It's different.
Excellent. Well, really, that was a very comprehensive answer. Thank you. Deborah, you had talked a little bit before, you know, obviously collectors are people and, you know, people learn differently. So how can collection agencies customize a training program to suit the different learning needs and speeds and styles of their collectors?
That is a great question, and it's not easy. And so, you know, one thing I've done that I have found very helpful is to use PowerPoint, as Irene was talking about, but to kind of the higher level. Mm-hmm. And I use it to create our microlearning modules. But, you know, you can record a PowerPoint presentation with narration, and then you save it as an MP4 and, you know, put that into the learning management system. And then now you're getting to the people who need to hear, who need to read. And then if you're really good, you'll set up some discussion sessions in your Zoom application. So get people to take the sessions and then bring them together for a meeting about the training that they just took, and have them discuss it. So then you're getting to people with basically all the different kind of needs, auditory, you know, visual learners, the people who just need to rehash it and talk about it before they learn it. Sometimes, like with compliance training, there's not a lot of doing, but you get to the sort of doing when you're listening to calls after the training and then giving people feedback on, gee, we talked about this last week and I heard you do exactly what I asked. You know, I heard you use that verbatim disclosure, or I heard you say please and thank you more often, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And so I think you have to look at all available tools and think about how you would do this if you were in person, and then how you can do it when you're remotely. And there really is a way. I mean, even if it just comes down to calling someone and saying, hey, I saw you took that training. I just want to spot check that I did it right, that I provided you with training that's useful. So it's not kind of, well, I'm calling you to make sure you did it, you paid attention and you learned it. That's one way to approach it. But I would like to say, I need your feedback on the training. Let's talk about it so I can improve it.
And Deborah, don't you think there are times that the hardest thing is, and I'm sure remotely is even harder, but when you have that person that you call or you're trying to get them to give you feedback and they give you the option of saying, I got it. Yeah, no, I understand. I got it. And you can never tell if they really have it or not. But yeah. Or worse, they don't have it and they're afraid to tell you they don't have it, but they figure, I got it, I'll just look it up later and figure it out for myself so she doesn't think I'm stupid.
Yeah. I get kind of drilled down and ask questions. Yeah, very specific questions.
The easiest way to get that person to open up to you was to ask those open-ended questions. Well, why don't you repeat back to what I said in your own words?
Yeah, exactly.
And things like that are going to make the difference. But if you're not doing that, you should be doing it for face-to-face too, but I think it's even more important to do it when it's remote because you can't see their body language as easy as you can face-to-face.
Right. One thing that we have done required.
Go ahead, Deborah.
No, you go ahead, Michael.
Getting them to respond, to make sure that they're repeating back to you. One of the biggest mistakes we can make is assuming that someone has received whatever it is that we're trying to give them. Online teaching is very difficult. I mean, I'm following pretty much the same format that you guys do. In-person training is where it's at. That is probably the most fun. I think it's the most effective for the time that you're spending. Getting the audio, getting the visual. I use a lot of gimmicks. Something to make whatever it is memorable. We have a skunk that I have right here. All right. And his name is Des P. Ute. And we learn about direct and indirect disputes using that stupid skunk. We have a Nerf gun that we have everybody shoot their manager in the back, with a target on their back, when going over talk offs, something to get them up moving and make this stuff memorable. So that they can then, take our tests and pass them. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's the key.
But we're not passing around anything right now. Nothing. Nobody's touching anything.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, everyone's going to get their own skunk.
Yeah. Hey, there's a good question in the chat box. In the question and answer, I'll just bring it up. And the question is, do the panelists have structured training schedules, and how long are they? Do they use experience collectors to assist with the training? So I'll answer that first, then I'll throw it to you guys. I like to use experience collectors to be the people who provide the examples. I like to use them as mentors. So you probably do this too, Irene, with your new hires. At some point in the training, I want a new hire to sit with an experience collector and observe, and not just kind of blindly sit there and, their attention goes here and there and everywhere else. I send them with a checklist. And so they're listening, and they're listening for verbatim disclosures. How did this person rebut this dispute, or not dispute, but just, reason for not paying or whatever the case may be. And then we come back and then we talk about what that experience collector did. And that is so helpful in a group setting when you have your people together, or even in a Zoom breakout, if you can do it that way, and just get them talking about what they heard the experience collectors do. To me, that's the best value you can get from an experience collector in training. Do you guys agree or disagree?
I'll add to that. I agree. They need to be not only for the learning, but for the bonding. They need to be with other collectors too. What we do during when we're face-to-face during initial training is those, because we initial train for about 10 to 14 days, depending on the size of the class and everything else. But during that 10 to 14 days, at least every other day, they are going and sitting for an hour chatting with a collector so they can see what they talked about that day, how it's applied. At the end of the training, we do what we call mentor week. We give a bonus to all the collectors, and we choose the collectors that we want to do this, because of course we want our collectors that do it right all the time to be the mentor. But they get a bonus for the week because they're not working as much on their accounts. They get to work on their own desk, but throughout that week, they get to become trainers. They have a person one-on-one that they're responsible for shadowing with them. The first day, that person's shadowing. The second day, that person is using the keyboard while the collector is making all the calls and everything else. The third day, they are now making simple calls without using the keyboard, like to verify their employment and things like that, where they're not speaking to consumers. By the end of the week, if the collector is comfortable, they have them making calls and using the keyboard while the collector is listening in on them. And then we have them sit with a supervisor after that for the supervisor to assess them to see if they're ready. But no one gets released on their own until the supervisor says, okay, I heard them and I think they're ready for us to be monitoring and watch them. But those, what's nice is they've bonded with those collectors, the ones they sat in during training. They got to know them a little bit, but the one they spent that weekend, they now have somebody they trust that they know in the office that wasn't upstairs in the classroom with them, that they weren't just now thrown on the floor with a whole new group of people. So it had a dual effect, really, really helps a lot. We've been trying to do that now remotely by still assigning that person, doing the remote connect and having them still spend the one-on-one. And we've only done it with two so far because we're hiring very small classes. But man, I was so impressed with how it worked. I mean, it was very close to what I wanted it to be. Still not, like Michael said, face-to-face is the best. You're not going to get anywhere near that with remote. But it was extremely workable. And the collector that was the new person, Tim, that was our new collector, he gave me feedback saying he loved it. Now, he doesn't know any better because he never did the face-to-face. But to him, he loved it and learned a lot. So do think outside the box.
Michael, do you experience collectors in your training?
Sometimes, not formally. I'll have a trainee shadow with them. And in fact, I mean, I do use experienced collectors for systems training because I can't get through it. I can't get through that. I try to only train on the fun stuff. So yeah, just in a very limited capacity. I want that trainee to, I want them to be loyal to themselves and loyal to the company, and not necessarily build up a loyalty to, you know, whomever the collector that's training them is. You know, I want them to be their own person and grow into their own person.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I don't know if I answered the structured training schedules, but we do assign people to training at certain times using our, you know, the learning management system, just so that we have good coverage on the phones, but it's kind of self-serve as well. So for new hire training, I guess we do about 8 or 9 days of new hire training. So.
I could suggest something that is also very helpful. We do something every year that we call, it's just our season collected to do it, but it's a Rockstar Roundtable, we call it. We take about 5 or 6 of our top collectors for that year, the ones that have, when I say top, I don't mean dollars. I mean, usually winds up being that anyway, but I mean the people that have had no complaints, no compliance issues, have really got the stuff, have been the forwarding leaders that are collectors. And we put them on a panel. We go over questions we're going to ask them. And then we have groups of collectors come in throughout the day and they get to ask that panel different questions. Like, what makes you start collector? How do you do this? You know, but we know what the questions that are going to be asking because they're on a list that we're sure they're going to be answering right. We have gotten such great feedback on that, where staff that is struggling or trying or learning, that they get to speak one-on-one or in this panel group with these seasoned collectors that are successful, and they realize, oh, I'm doing that. And it's nice when you hear the collector say, yeah, I remember when I was doing that too. It just takes time. Be patient. Don't forget, just hit period end and keep going. You'll get to the accounts. But it was amazing to see that learning that they got through those experienced collectors on our Rockstar Roundtable. Plus, it made them feel really good that they got to be asked to do something like that, and you know that they felt that we trusted them enough.
So I've got a question for you guys. So both of you have given an indication of the timeline to train a collector, and I think I heard nine days. What is in the content of 9 days, or what? Tell me about the content that makes that process take so long.
Well, I'll go first, Deborah.
Please.
We have all departments in our training. When we hire all departments. We have a lot of departments. We also have legal staff, and because we have on-staff attorneys and a huge client service staff. So when we hire, it's usually somebody from every department. It's not usually just collectors.
Okay.
But everybody needs to learn the laws. So what we look at with initial is everybody gets above a nice overlook of what the collection agency is, the laws we all have to follow, to have a true understanding about what everybody's dealing with. That usually is the first 5 days of collections. But within that, we have computer-based training, we have hands-on training, we have worksheets, we have lecture, we have testing, we have people that come in, different people that are specialists, like if I have a really good skip trace, we'll come in and talk about what they're doing and things like that. So, and we have that shadowing that I mentioned built into it also. We also play a ton of games and activities, including Deborah introduced me to Dingbats. But we have a whole bunch of different activities that we do to keep it fun, because it is sometimes very boring if you don't include those things. So it winds up stretching it out. The second week is more tailored towards the individual department. During that time, we're getting a little bit more, like, for instance, we break into groups. Collectors will listen to collector calls. Legal will listen to legal calls. Client services will listen to client service calls. You know, you get the idea that we kind of break it up a little bit. We're still all talking about it together about, okay, what did you find out? But that second week is more of the detail of what that person is going to do in their department. We're not really doing a lot of, okay, do it for me on a real call. We're doing more of, this is what it looks like. They're going to do that doing for me on a real call that third week when they're in that mentor week. So our collectors aren't on their own for at least 3 weeks. But when we used to do it shorter, we found there was so many more mistakes those first couple of months. We hardly had anybody making mistakes the first couple of months. I mean, we also meet with them every single Friday after they're released on their own. Their class will meet with the trainer or with me or with a lead to ask, so how'd this week go? So what did you find? To try to force them to talk to us, and it works. But we put a lot on those first 3 weeks of training. Plus, it also helps our trainer to see that this person is getting extremely overwhelmed. We know when to cut our losses earlier instead of waiting for them to make a mistake to cut our losses. What do you think, Deborah?
Well, I would say a lot of what I've done at every agency I've worked at has been very similar. You know, and I've kind of gone back and forth on, is it better to teach collection techniques first, or you want to teach compliance first? And, you know, I've gone back and forth on that, and I like to get people talking about other people, you know, not gossiping about people, but what are people like that you're going to be talking with? What are their characteristics, and how are we going to appeal to them? And, you know, we listen to a lot of examples and a lot of calls to, especially those collectors that we feel like are really able to connect with consumers. And so we'll talk about that and just approaching people first. And that can be a couple of days. And then we'll talk about, okay, well, let's talk about how they're doing it. What's the setting? And we'll talk about compliance then. And, you know, if your company is a data furnisher, you have a lot more to train related to compliance than if you're not. And so we're teaching FDCPA, we're teaching FCRA. We talk a lot about handling disputes and what our processes are and what the timelines are. And, you know, I could spend probably 3 or 4 days on compliance. And agencies don't like it because they feel like you're going to scare people away. But I really do feel like
if you scare them away, then you did a good job.
Yes. Well, yeah, I guess so. Right. But I just don't want someone to come back to me and say, I never got that in training. So, you know, and when you're training so much material, you have to build in time for repetition. And that's what those games and activities that Irene is talking about, that's what those are all about. So you can tell somebody something, but until they have to apply it or bring back that knowledge in order to succeed at a game, they lose it. So you want to take the time and be relaxed in the training. You don't want to feel people like you're just shoving them down a pipe to just get it done and then get on the job. So,
and there's so much to learn. They're not going to remember it all. The only way is to repeat.
Well, the learning never stops.
Repeating differently. And, you know, yes, you read it in this book. Yes, you saw it on this CD. Now you played a game for it, and now you're going to witness somebody doing it. That's going to dig it in and make it more of a good habit instead of creating bad habits or wrong understanding of things. And just, okay, well, we went over this yesterday. You should know it now. Mm-hmm. When you do it that way, no, I don't. What if I, you know, for a second I sneezed and I wasn't paying attention to that one thing you said? I mean, I truly believe, what if I'm a kinetic learner? And yeah, I know that you were saying it, but nothing sunk in. That's why through different games and tests and things like that, you're solidifying the education. And we do surveys after. We do new hire surveys that we send out after day one, because day one is totally different than the rest of the training. That's more HR stuff and things like that. And then we send out at the end of a classroom training, we send out another survey for them to fill out, asking questions that are very general, like, you know, how did you like training? What did you like best? What did you find the hardest? All that kind of stuff. Was there someone to greet you the day you got in? You know, all different things like that. And it is amazing when they come back with comments about how they say, oh, I wish that, you know, it was great. I didn't get it until I played that game. That game was great. And things like that to make us know that, yeah, this is working. And we've done this for years. And I'm very proud of our training program, because we produce awesome collectors, in my opinion, in a very short time. When we had a manager at one time that kept insisting we should get them on the floor faster. They could learn faster. We reduced our training to 8 days total with everything, 8 days. I cannot tell you how many people after just a month or two were out the door. And it wasn't even always because we sent them home. It was because they were saying, this is just too overwhelming. And we knew it was because they really didn't get it. And then when they were on the floor, they were like totally overwhelmed. And we do medical collections. And like I said, we do have legal. So there's more, a lot of more stuff that they have to consider. When we added time back to the training, those numbers stopped. We maintained people and had a lot less errors, a lot less complaints. It was amazing. Like such a noticeable difference. It was amazing. That I feel it's worth it. I'd rather put the days in the beginning.
So I've got a few luxuries in being a 25 seat shop.
Yeah.
And picking the absolute best person to learn this information as quickly as possible is a luxury that I have that maybe you guys don't, you know, just be simply because of volumes. I think I would just die if I had to take 8 days, you know.
Yeah.
Interesting. Small. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and we have a question that kind of relates to this from one of our attendees. Our attendees wants to know if it's better to send a new hire to like on the job training after training, or do they want to go straight to the collection floor? And I think what he means is like, just as an example, one thing that I have found very successful is to put people in what we call a nesting environment. Other people call it rookie row or something, where they're very heavily supervised. The trainer may follow them out to the area where you're going to have them do nesting, and they're taking calls and they're making calls. But, you know, there's a good portion of the day that is just retraining based on their performance of what you trained in the classroom. And so I like that approach because it's a little bit less stressful than being on a dialer and have call after call coming in and they don't even have time to regroup and they don't know if they did something wrong or right. And, hey, how do I do this in the system? Because I forgot that training was 4 weeks ago, you know. And so in that nested environment, they can feel free to raise their hand, ask for help, you know, talk to the person. Hopefully you've got some experienced people kind of interspersed with your new hire so that there's a buddy right there that can ask a question. So I'm a strong believer in that. And so you don't really, you probably don't measure sort of production performance, right, Irene, within that first maybe month or 6 weeks on the job. You expect them to improve.
Yeah.
Day after day or week after week, but you don't have the same like goals and expectations them as you would your more experienced collectors, right?
Right. We tell them when they're about to go on the floor, I don't expect you to make great decisions right now, but I do expect you to make good ones. And as time goes on, you'll make great decisions. You'll look back at your own calls from now and you'll be saying, why didn't I just do that while I was in the account then? Because you'll learn as you go. But I'm not expecting greatness now, but I am expecting you to think of what you're doing and make good decisions.
So I'm sorry. The person that asked that question just had a follow-up, and I think this is very helpful. And the follow-up was, hey, how long should that last, that nesting? And so what we did is created a checklist. And so the supervisor or the trainer who's monitoring them during nesting checks off. I've observed them do this. You know, you have maybe 15 or 20 things, what the most important things that you want them to perform, right? And so maybe I've observed them seeking location information and they did it correctly. Check. They got that. And so when they've completed that checklist to our satisfaction, I think they're ready to go and sit on their own desk for a day and see how well they do. And you might not release everyone from nesting at the same time. Some people might just need to be there a couple of days. They've proven they can perform and then off they go. And other people might need a little more hand holding. And that's, I think you can individualize it at that point.
Definitely. Definitely. It sounds close to what we're doing with the end of mentoring week, the same type of thing, because if we don't feel they're ready, they will have more days of shadowing either with a lead, a supervisor, or another seasoned collector.
Right. Well, and that also helps you weed out the people that just aren't going to make
it.
You know,
yeah, there's some people that are great in the classroom and they're terrible when they get on the floor. I remember this one guy, I was so excited to get him on the floor. First time I picked up the phone, I'm like, say hello. I mean, he couldn't even
froze up, huh?
Say hi. He just froze completely.
It's the ones that always talk the biggest, you know what I mean? That when they get out there, freeze up. Now, one thing that we do is before we put somebody in a collector position, we do require them do a couple of days as a point caller, where they're simply making outbound telephone calls, identifying the consumer, and getting them to a collector. That's really great to kind of gauge, all right, how comfortable is this person going to be before they can cost you too much money, I suppose.
Well, one way right. That helps with that too, we have a pooled environment and we use a company that scores and medals our accounts. So we have a pool of what we call bronze accounts that basically everything on those are automated. Those are accounts with low propensity to pay, very small balances, you know, things like that, that really just not worth the collector's time, more like a value-added service for our clients. So we do some stuff, but not a lot of human stuff on it. It's more
automated. We put them in the junk files too.
Yeah. So what we do is a brand new collector.
And you know what? I'm pretty forthcoming with the collectors when that happens. I say, look, you're not going to break this stuff. It's already broken. All right. So.
And they're not as complicated. They're smaller packets, things like that. So we do. We'll have them for a couple of days sign into that bronze pool to work accounts, so they're not so intimidating before we put them on the best pool.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Someone else is asking how we have our collectors sign off on training when it's been completed so that they acknowledge, you know, do you guys do that? You have people acknowledge that they got trained on things. And I've used a checklist before so that at the end of every unit, you know, we also quiz them. So we've got the quizzes as, you know, sort of proof that they completed the training, but you can actually have them sort of sign off on each unit as they finish it. And then there's no going back to say, well, I wasn't trained on that, because we have evidence that they were. Do you guys see that?
Yeah, we even have sign-off sheets on understanding the mini Miranda. Something as simple as they understand the rule, because we go above and beyond with the mini Miranda than what the FDCPA says. We do get it on every single communication, and we say it only a certain way, and we say it at a certain time in the phone call and things like that. And we have a whole thing they have to sign off on the bottom, even after initial training on that. There's about 8 sheets they have to sign off on throughout training.
Yeah, there's so we do sign offs, but really the testing is where you figure it out. And I've had people tell me, I don't do well on tests, to which I always think, okay, you don't do well when we find out what you know. but that's where the micro learning comes in, to make sure it's reinforced. And if they're having issues understanding, E8 violations or something, all right, you can really drill down on that so that they can get over that little hump of whatever issue that they're having. Acknowledgement of the training is pretty crucial. And with all the testing that we do, I double dog dare somebody to tell me that they have seen this before.
Oh yeah. We do something called the general collector knowledge test, and it's a hard test. And there's a lot of questions, like 156 questions on it. But they only give it once a year. We give it once a year to every single collector. It really is, in my opinion, if you know what you're doing, no matter how many questions are on it, it's easy, because they're the things you're doing every single day already. We tell them it's closed book. They're not allowed to ask anybody. They have to do it all in one sitting, and it's pass or fail. That's it. There's no grade that's given. It's just pass or fail. The idea is that we're trying to figure out what they know and what they don't know. I mean, it's something, even some questions are as simple as, why do we give the mini Miranda, or what does FDCPA stand for? And it's amazing how a seasoned collector will, and it's multiple choice, and it's seasoned collectors will even miss that sometimes, but they get the good stuff. And the idea is for us to see, are they still using what we taught them a year ago? Every single year, the collectors are used to this test and they get the same test. And I love it. It's kind of comical watching a collector do it for the first time. And then we actually all meet in a group, well, we have a few of them, but we sit down and we go over every single question and answer and tell them why this was no, why this was yes. And even I have collectors that are working for us for over 20 years. And even those collectors will always say each year, I love when we do this test because it always reminds me of so much stuff I forget about.
And that would make me sweat bullets, that 156 question test.
156 questions on our, it's our own test on our software, on our, you know, what, mm-hmm. what do you hit when you, what's the action code for this?
You take it yourself, right?
What's that?
You take it yourself, right?
Oh, 100%. I pass it 100% every single time.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, Irene.
So you guys, we have a very specific question that this person has been waiting many minutes for this response. And so I think we should address it. And that is, tips on training a rude collector. So wants to go first?
Michael? I got this. Yeah, I'm pretty good at it. You know, I've got this superpower where I can just make anybody feel terrible. So a rude collector. Our environment here, our employees like this environment. I like this environment. And our staff, they will defend the environment that we have here. Mm-hmm. Our staff will not put up with somebody being hateful or rude. And I don't know if it's the best HR position to take here, but I rarely have to get involved. But if you have a collector that's being openly rude and they're not normally openly rude, to me, that's an indicator that something is wrong. In looking at training context, it could be frustration. And that's how they're expressing themselves, that they're not understanding something. They're not getting something. If they're doing it in a public setting, you know, I mean, you got to deal with that pretty swiftly and just say, hey, you know, at what point did it seem appropriate to do this in front of everybody? And that usually takes care of something like that. But yeah, find out why they are being rude. Sometimes I'll challenge folks and ask them why they're refusing to learn. And that normally gets them thinking for a little while.
It's funny you mentioned that. I had a collector a couple of years back. I loved her. She was awesome. I mean, this girl can collect it from anybody. And then suddenly I started hearing things, like hearing slamming things and hear stuff. And I started listening, and I listened to some of her calls, and she was not just rude. She was getting like almost to the point of, you know, does she need to be institutionalized? And I called her into my office and I asked her what was wrong. And she goes, I just want to kill them all. I'm like, what? She goes, they're all so stupid. I just want to go to this guy's house and strangle him. I said, okay, as of now, you're off the phone, first of all. And I asked her what was going on, and she said she's just getting so burnt out, and it's like the same thing over and over again with people that they say the same stuff. I said, okay, I didn't want to lose her, but I knew that she couldn't be on the phone anymore. So I gave her other things to do. I made her do some of my reports. I did all this other stuff. I allowed her to be on the phone for an hour a day. We talked about it. We had a whole bunch of stuff. We talked. She cried. But an hour a day, she's allowed to be on the phone, and I would monitor her. Through all the other things that she did, in about 3 months, I would say it took, 3 months we did this, I could see her becoming herself again. I found out later on there was something going on at home with her and her boyfriend that was triggering all this. But 3 months later, she came to me and she goes, you know, I can't believe I don't feel that way anymore. I can't believe I was even feeling that way. She goes, thank you for taking me off the phone, but I really think I can go back on. I still told her, okay, 2 hours a day is your max, and only at an hour at a time until we figure this out. She stayed with me for years before she moved out of state. She wound up becoming one of my trainers. She wound up creating training material that was unbelievable, because I didn't just say, okay, you're out the door. And I looked at her for the talents that she has, but realized, okay, I got to pull this back. And I think that's our first goal, is to say, well, if you don't fix it, you're out of here. But you got to look at the person itself. If that person is a valuable person, it might be somewhere else in your company that they could actually help the collectors. Like I said, it was shocking. She became one of my best trainers. I was so sad when she moved out of state. I'd have her back in a minute.
You are so kind, Irene, I can tell you. I mean, to me, it's kind of a will versus skill issue. It's like, can they be, you know, polite? And, or are they refusing to be polite? And do they know how to be polite? You know, do they know what our expectations are? And, you know, to me, if they just don't want to, they're like, these people don't deserve it. Or the one thing that gets me the worst is when someone says, well, that's just the way I am, because anyone can change. And once you're aware of a behavior that's not acceptable, it's your choice to change it. And if you're not willing to change it, and I can't train it out of you, because if you just choose to be that way, then I'd be the one person that says, you know, this isn't worth my time. And I think you need to find somewhere that will be better, you know, better for you as a person, and just let them go. Because,
you know, I resolve that everybody I employ, there's no requirement for them to be a polite person. There's no requirement for them to be an empathetic person. There is a requirement for them to sound like a polite person would.
So, well, I almost fight with my daughter for that same reason when she worked for me, my middle child. She's very scary. She's tall. She's very big. She's very dark looking. And she has eyes that could look like she's a teacher now. So as you could tell, it's perfect, middle school teacher. But when she was working for me as a collector, I would overhear her saying on the phone, ma'am, that's just my voice. I'm not trying to be rude, ma'am. It's just my voice. And I called her in my office. I said, I love you. And I know that you could do this, but if you don't fix this, you're out of here. I said, so here's your one shot. Of course, she said, but you're my mother. I said, that's right. So I know you could do this. But tomorrow we're coming in. It's Saturday for 3 hours. I'll come in with you. I want you to have sugar pouring out of every orifice of your body every single time you speak to a consumer. And we'll talk at the end of the day. When we were driving home that afternoon on Saturday, I said, so how'd it go? She goes, first of all, I have a terrible headache. She goes, besides that, you're right. She goes, not one person said anything. I got so many more payments. And she developed this great talk off where people even say to her, why are you asking how their day is and how funny that? She goes, because I'm afraid if they hear my voice after a while, they might think I'm rude. But she wound up working for me through all of college, and she became one of my top collectors. But I was ready to let her out the door because I can't have that, my daughter or not.
There you go.
So we talked about rude collectors. Someone asked, what do you do with collectors who are too nice? Is that a problem any of you have had to deal with?
And it depends on the collector, really. So one of the more memorable collectors I've had in my career, Irene, I'm writing this down, sugar pouring out of every orifice. All right. That's going to be the quote of the day for sure. But
from New York, I can't help it. I say it.
Right. She had sugar pouring out of every orifice for sure. She was so sugary sweet, but was a cold-blooded killer on the phone. And she could drop bombs on these consumers that very few people could ever get away with. I mean, if I said something, you know, stuff like she was saying, it would just not come out well at all. So if they can recognize that and appropriately harness toward an end goal, it can be an incredible strength for that collector.
I worry about the word too nice in that question, though, because if they're too nice, meaning they're giving too many chances, they're setting too low payment plans and things like that, that kind of too nice needs to be addressed.
Oh, you want me to call you back? Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, oh, don't worry about it. You can just send it next month. You're fine. No, that kind of too nice is not acceptable, but you could be too nice. I had a collector tell me, I had one like you're talking about, who she's very low. She doesn't speak loudly. She's so friendly, but she could tell you no where you're thanking her at the end. She could tell you where she's saying, no, I can't do that. But you're like, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm not going to be able to do that. It's amazing how she says no, but she's so nice about it. I don't think being nice is a bad thing. I think having a too nice person is actually a tool, but there's a difference between mistaking niceness for weakness, because if that person is being weak, that's a different kind of nice I'm not going to have and I can't stand for. But if a person is being nice and they're getting that person to bond in that few minutes phone call, go for it. I mean, you should be taking that person and trying to teach them the things like Michael said, how to handle that niceness in a way where you can say no friendly and the person is still saying, well, thank you at the end of the phone call. It could be a tool.
Having a tool and being a tool.
Yeah. What do you think, Deborah? You agree?
I agree with that. I mean, you know, everybody has those collectors that get the thank you cards, mm-hmm. or the flowers on Valentine's Day from a consumer, you know, that says, you know, you were so nice. You really helped me out of a pickle. You know, nobody's ever treated me that way. Thank you so much. And, you know, it says a lot about being nice versus, I love what you said, being nice versus being weak is a huge difference. And so I think the collectors that are nice to their own detriment, those are the ones that we have to work with.
Yeah.
You know, they're not meeting goal or they're not performing.
Put them in client service department. Add them to your client service department. Clients will love them.
There you go. That works.
Excellent. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. We've hit the top of the hour, so I have to wrap up our discussion. But Irene, Deborah, Michael, thank you so much for your participation today. This was really, really a great discussion. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Thanks again to our panelists. Thanks to Chris Rickman and Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. But most importantly, thanks to all of you for watching and listening today. I hope you're walking away with some great information. I can't imagine how you're not. But I hope you are. Thanks for your participation and thanks for watching today. Stay tuned. We've got webinars coming up tomorrow on today's Supreme Court hearing, and Thursday on advisory opinions, and Friday on time-barred debt. So hopefully you signed up for all of those. And if not, then I encourage you to go do that now. But thank you to everybody, and thanks to our panelists and our sponsor one last time. Stay tuned. We'll be back. I hope everyone stays safe and take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Thank you.